Blog Talk Radio.
What's the topic? We'll never run out of options. Fatherhood to justice, O'Shea and Mark drop the knowledge. These are times where we try for a peace of mind, organize and then reignite with these words from the other side.
We're two good brothers, unpacked. Meaningful conversations centered in solutions that transmute the systemic energy of being black in America, where each episode is packed with inspirational messages and thought-provoking special guests. Come join us on the other side.
You're listening to E-Water Radio, KEWRDB.
The views and comments expressed do not reflect the opinions of E-Water Radio. All comments and views are show guest views and comments and in no way reflect views or comments of E-Water Radio, KEWRDB, or its affiliates.
Welcome, 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 everybody. Welcome back to the other side, where we try to bring healing, laughter, and intelligent conversation. Is that right, my partner in upliftment and education, O'Shea Lugia? Are you with me?
Absolutely, man. I'm with you. Glad to be on. Brother, onward and upward.
Onward and upward, brother. That's the goal, brother. That's the goal. I think when we talk about one of the goals and one of the inspirations, me wanting to come to, you know, do this work is to do my part to help people move onward and upward. Who said that, brother? That was a line from some famous person. I don't know.
Man, or it could have well been somebody, great uncle, man, in the pool hall somewhere.
And onward and upward, brother. To the next level of the pool room. Is that what you're saying, brother?
Right. Or the upper room, one of those rooms. Indeed.
The upper room. There we go, brother. There we go.
Yes.
Well, brother, we have an exciting episode. I'm excited about all our episodes, brother, but I'm particularly excited about this one, brother, because we have a special guest on. I've known this brother for a while. I guess you can say my whole life. And we're going to be talking about a subject matter that is very dear to me, man. We're going to be talking about family court from the perspective of custody. And we have with us, having this very important conversation, Attorney Maury Winkler. Just a little bit about Attorney Winkler. He received his Juris Doctorate from Rutgers Law in New Jersey way back when, somewhere around 1989. His legal career started in New York. He was an assistant corporation counsel, and he can tell us a little bit about that when we bring him on. And he cut his teeth in family court system. He appeared in front of a famous judge we all know in family court before she went on television, perhaps, Judge Judy Shineland. So I want to know, we're going to ask him, was she as tough then as she appears on television? He went on to expand his legal prowess, his legal career. He went into the entertainment industry, where he represented such artists as Nelly, Alicia Keys, Mos Def, KRS-One, Trick Daddy, Jaheim, and several more. He's a very well-respected person in this community. Do we have Attorney Maury Winkler with us? Are you on the other side, Attorney Winkler?
I am firmly on the other side, my brother. Yes, I am. I'm here.
So let me ask you this, man. Judge Judy Shineland, was she the tough judge that we see on television, or was that more or less an act she developed later on?
Brother, she walks it like she talks it. She was counselor, where you going, you know? just like she acted on TV, she acted just like that in her role as a as a Manhattan Family Court judge. You know, she was tough, she was colorful, you know, and she was definitely right on your heels. So she absolutely was the same way.
Did she ever have to downsize you, brother? Did you come in there thinking you were more prepared than you were? Did she ever have to put you in your place?
Well, I mean, like as I said in my bio, I cut my teeth there, so I was a young attorney, and yeah, she definitely you know pushed my ears back a couple of times, but I mean, no more than anyone else. I mean, I was a good student of the game, but yeah, she definitely straightened me out and put me on a good path. Yeah, I would say.
There you go. Well, each week before we get going, and I want to jump right into this conversation because you'll be surprised how quickly an hour goes, but we always want to hold space and acknowledge individuals that have passed away. And this time go around, I want to hold space for the victims that lost their lives in two mass shootings. First, the Atlanta killings, which happened last week. I believe there were 8 individuals killed in that tragic shooting. And then just yesterday, 10 more individuals taken in a senseless mass shooting in Boulder, Colorado. So we want to hold space in our hearts for the ones who have lost loved ones, for the ones who are affected emotionally and impacted emotionally by these senseless crimes. So we want to always acknowledge those who have lost their lives. We want to continue to hold space and recognize those who are still suffering during this COVID crisis, those who have lost their lives, over 500,000, and those who have lost income, those who have lost their jobs. We want to hold space for them because, you know, some of us, we have gone through this year and we have not gotten our lives taken too far off course, other than not being able to go out in the public atmosphere, the public sphere. But there are those who are deeply struggling. And just recently, there was some small level of relief that came with the latest stimulus monies that hit. But still, yet there is still a lot of struggling and a lot of loss around there. So we want to hold space. And of course, we want to continue to hold space for those individuals from my community who lost their lives to reckless behavior from law enforcement. We want to keep a close eye on the George Floyd case, which is happening right now. So we definitely want to continue to keep those brothers and sisters in our hearts and our minds and continue to pray for their families. That's very important. So, Attorney Winkler.
Yes, sir.
We want to jump right into this conversation because, like I said, you're going to be surprised how quickly this conversation about this conversation we have, how quickly it goes by. So I want to start with just asking, you know, sort of just some general questions. And I just want to just put out there very quickly that Attorney Winkler will not be giving legal advice. That's not what he's doing here. He's giving legal education. There is a distinct difference. Is that correct, Attorney Winkler?
That's correct. The information that, first of all, I'm admitted to the bars of New Jersey and New York. I'm trying to, I do want to speak to, I know you have a national audience about the state of the law in general, but, right, I'm giving information only, and I am not giving specific legal advice for anyone's particular situation. That's correct.
All right, so now we got that disclaimer out the way. So I want to look at 5 components of family law, specifically dealing with custody. And I want to start by talking about the basics of custody and visitation orders, because I think a lot of people, when they come into this process, that's the first thing they say, will I be able to continue seeing my child? Right, that's a fear.
That's right.
That's a fear that keeps people from the court because they feel they go in, they may lose what little time they have or the time, not little, sometimes immense contact, or if there's a marginal contact. So let's talk about the different types of custody orders that we people will encounter when they go into this process.
Okay. All right. I think that's a good place to start. See, because people use that term, I've got custody of my son, I've got custody of my daughter, very loosely and often incorrectly. There are two basic types of custody. You got legal custody and you got physical custody. Now, legal custody is an arrangement where most people are going to have legal custody unless there's a problem with one parent or the other and they're unable to communicate. Most people are given legal custody or joint legal custody, rather, and that is to say that you're given the right to be involved in your child's life as the major decisions, like if one parent, say a mother had physical custody, the children resided with them, and the father enjoyed visitation, or vice versa, both parents would have a say-so in how the child is raised, what religion the child would be, what school would the child be attending. And you couldn't just up and move away as long as, you know, there's that legal relationship there in place that, you know, so you always have an input, you have access to medical records, school records, that sort of thing. And then there's physical custody, and that's who the child actually resides with most of the time. Two parties can share, have exercise parenting time during the week. Maybe one will have 2 days, one will have 5 days, but generally one person is going to have primary residential custody and the other will have a visitation or a parenting time, or be the parent of alternate visitation, as we say in New Jersey.
In your experience, let me ask you this. In your experience, what determines that? What determines who gets?
Right.
Is it the age of the child, or what determines that?
Yeah, well, they're going to be several factors. The age of the child is going to be one. Now, there used to be something on the books called the, you know, especially here on the East Coast, called the tender years presumption, where they talk about a mother being best for a child in its early years. Those types of notions are long gone, and in fact, men are getting custody in nearly half the cases, believe it or not. So, you know, as laws change
on the East Coast.
That's a national sort of a trend because what's happening,
okay,
the laws are changing, especially and it's very important that you jump out there and you jump on your custody case very early on. Now, if you wait and you let one parent, like you'll have brothers who will allow that child to just stay with the mother for a lot of years early on until the child gets older, then you're up against a whole different battle. But if you press those rights right from the beginning, you know, or right as you're breaking up, you know, you stand a much better chance of getting a divided custody or even winning custody altogether. It's an objective test. Yeah, they're going to look at the age of the child. I mean, and that goes two ways, you know, too young, too old. I mean, sometimes you're coming in trying to change custody at 16. Like, guess what? You know, it's a little late for that, you know. So
you get
issues like that. You're going to look at the health of the child. Is there one parent more suited to care for a child with special needs, or one more involved and more knowledgeable of the needs of the child?
Hold on one second because I want to back up for a second. I definitely want, because that's another realm of that going into custody determinations, and I definitely want to expand on that. But before we move into that, I just want to talk about, because you mentioned something I think was important, and I think a lot of fathers, you know, they hesitate on this point that you just mentioned about getting in first, about going
get in first, get in early,
and yep, filing. Talk to the fathers out there who are, and I'm not saying this show, it's not just about fathers, right? But I personally deal with the work that I do. I deal with a lot of fathers, and there is a lot of anxiety around going into court, right? So
right,
because they feel like, and there's a lot with that, right? And O'Shea, you know, it's not just about you know, the fact of like not being able to, you know, losing whatever rights you have. There's historical right. stuff about going into court. You know,
it is.
So,
right.
I just
oh
talk
yeah,
about
oh
that
yeah,
a little
yeah,
bit.
No, I, yeah, yeah, I got you.
And to get in there first.
Right, and look, and you're spot on with that. When I said those words about, you know, guys wanting to have the cases these days, that's very recent. Now, historically speaking, brothers, you know, have had a difficult time in the court system. There's no question about it, and in many places they still do. You know, largely, you know, due to the timing, you know, on their applications. But if you're coming in right at the beginning, you know, right when that child is born, right when the split up takes place, you're on equal footing at that point. It's when you it's when you wait, you let one party, you know, exercise control, and then you're coming in seeking to change things, and you got a big obstacle to overcome. You have to establish a change of circumstances, and that's a fairly difficult threshold, you know, to meet. You know, they're going to look at, I mean, change of circumstances. You got to come with something like, you know, someone relocated, someone's on drugs now, someone's got a new spouse that's crazy or something. You know, someone's relocating, you know, someone lost a job or got a new difficult job. So the timing of it is everything, but I don't want people to feel that they can't go in there. You have equal, guys have equal rights as the ladies do on these applications, provided that you're starting off right at square one. You're starting right when you're splitting or right when the child is born. You know, and then you just judge equally on your merits. People always feel that they're getting a raw deal or whatever, but you're coming in late. You've already let that other person establish themselves as the parent of primary custody, and it's like they're throwing rocks down the hill at you, as opposed to you're fighting on an equal battlefield. You know.
So I think a lot of people frame. And it's interesting you use that terminology, fighting and battlefield, right? Because most of the times we hear about custody is that custody battle, right? And you take that framework and you put it in how we perceive fighting and battle, right? There's a certain sort of consciousness that, you know, and their consciousness, what people think about when they're going into such an arena, right? But when you're preparing this paperwork, right? Say, for instance, if you have a father and they're preparing this paperwork, not necessarily specific legal advice, like what words to put in, but what are some of the things you would suggest or educate fathers around, if you were teaching a class, to stay away from putting in their paperwork, right? Language or, yeah, like, for instance, I give you a for instance. A lot of fathers feel like they should put in all the bad things that the mother has done, right? And right. a lot of times that's personal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are personal feelings, personal encounters with the mother. So if you had to have a rule of thumb, right, they say, what's the word they use? In the best interest of the child, I guess is what I'm driving at. So
that's exactly what the standard is. It's all about the best interest of the child. While it's okay to point out some serious flaws that the other person may have, because that may impact, you know, the best interest of the child. I've seen that backfire. I've seen women go in and say, well, he smokes weed and he does this, he does that. Well, you were with him for 10 years while he was doing it, so obviously you must have thought that was okay during that time,
right.
You know?
So
you know, that's
a fasting or
right,
what's going
right.
on
so
over there?
Double, that's a double-edged sword. So to that end, you don't want to go in necessarily, you know, bashing the other person. Instead, you want to get down to the best interest of the child. Jersey's has got 12 factors, you know. It's a little bit more extensive than what I've seen in the California list, but they're going to look at things like the child's ties to the schools, you know, his home or his other siblings, any history of family violence or substance abuse, the abilities of the parents to actually care for the child. Some guys just work all the time, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, who's going to take care of the kid during the day?
Why, right.
Yeah, that's right, O'Shea. So that torpedoes some of the dads just then. I mean, and I'll see guys say, well, she's just on public assistance and she doesn't want anything for herself. Brother, she's a stay-at-home mom, you know? She's there taking care of the kid all day, so she's got one up on you, you know?
Right.
So, you know, yeah, so that ability of the parents to care for the child, you know, can really impact, you know, that best interest equation.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to look at things like, and actually they get into the child's preference as well. Like once a child gets to be a certain age, say 12 to 14, the courts will take a child in chambers and have an in-camera interview. What do you think? Who do you want to be with? Why do you want to be here? So, you know, yeah, like an 8-year-old, you know, like maybe wants to be with me. Like 8-year-olds don't make decisions, okay? You know, you give them an ice cream cone and they're anybody's, you know?
Right.
But when a kid starts to become a third age, generally like 12, like, yeah, generally 12 to like a 14. Type of you know, and anything over above that, you know, definitely they're going to talk to them, because at a certain point, 16, look, I don't want to be here, I'm out, you know. So then that's the way that goes, you know.
Let me ask you this:
the ethnicity, right, of the couple, you know, in Jersey, is it more so that it's more of the ebony, you know, people that's having kind of these divides, or does it cross over all cultures, all barriers? I know it does, but I'm saying, what is the highest percentage of going through this energy in Jersey?
Well, I would say that it definitely transcends color lines, brother. I mean, you know, everyone breaks up. Everybody's got color issues. We facing more economic challenges oftentimes will not have an attorney, and that can definitely impact your rights quite a bit, you know, if you're going in there. I mean, I always encourage people, if they have the resources, to just go ahead and pony up and spend the money on an attorney if you can. This is like a one-time thing, and it can impact you for the rest of your life. You know, you know, people just want to go in there and represent themselves. And if you do, I mean, that's okay. You know, well, it's you know, but if you're gonna do it, you gotta really prepare. I mean, you go online, you know, you study up, you find out what those child custody factors are. You read some of the case law in your local jurisdiction. You see what's going on. But to get back to your question, it can be it can affect us a little bit. You know, disproportionately, because we don't have the resources to hire counsel at times, and you do have some racist judges out there. You know, I mean, most of them, you know, are still going to be, you know, most of them are still, you know, older white people. I mean, we're getting there. You know, that you're starting to get some equality and on the bench, and you know, people, you know, more and more attorneys are, you know, black and Spanish attorneys are transitioning into that work, but. Yeah, there's just a lot of racism, man, and it's like, next, and like, I don't care who gets this kid, let me just do my job.
Right.
So that happens, you know. I couldn't talk to you with a straight face and say that doesn't happen, you know. So yeah, you know, we get affected in that way. That's why I always encourage people, you know, just try to make it happen. You got a lot of good brothers and sisters out there who will work with you, and you know, there are even some volunteer attorney organizations, but at a very minimum, don't go in there like a cowboy. Going up into your hand, well, I'm just going to tell them what the deal is. No, just go on, you know, right now this is the age of the internet. Go on to Google, just check it out. How do I win a custody case in California?
Yeah.
How do I win a custody case in Idaho?
Yes.
You know, and man, that goes a long, long way.
Mark, this is a good one right here.
Yeah, man. Try to help you.
He's been in the game too long not to know his stuff, man. So, Attorney, let's move on here. Let's talk about the types of visitations. You talked about it a little bit before in some elements, but let's talk about the types of visitations, because people may, you know, they may think that, you know, they may go in thinking that, well, it's going to be a 50-50 split automatically, right? Or just talk about this. So talk about, you know, break down the different types, if you will, sort of quickly, then if there's anything we want to add with that or question you about, we will.
Okay. All right. Well, getting back to the different types of custody, we talked about the legal, we talked about the physical custody.
Mm-hmm.
And you get hybrid with that. You can have joint physical custody where you literally 1 week on, 1 week off, a straight 50-50, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And or you get sole custody, times where you know, maybe say one of the parties is locked up and it's just not physically, it's not reasonable for me to be trying to call up and consult this person on major decisions with the child, or you get someone maybe who's violent or something and I'm not going to be dealing with them either and talking to them, you know, and then we can't communicate, you get sole custody. And then you have to look at the type of visitation that a person is going to get. There in California, I think you guys call it reasonable visitation. New York, New Jersey, we call it liberal visitation. That's where there's not necessarily defined, but like you can get the kid whenever you want. It's cool with me. We're cool with each other, and you know we don't need a set visitation schedule. Or whenever the kid's ready to go over your place, he goes over your place. Maybe we're living in proximity, or maybe we just have a good relationship like that. And, you know, and with that, you know, the step down from that may be a visitation according to a schedule. You'll hear a lot of brothers will have every other weekend. And you would think it would be every weekend, but the thought being behind, you know, giving every other weekend is that one parent can't just be the mean parent responsible for taking care of the schooling and everything, and never have any fun time with the child. So, you know, you may have a structured, visitation according to a schedule. And then you get a worse type of visitation, which is called supervised visitation. That's when you've shown a propensity to basically not know how to act, and the court's got to make sure that there's a person there to keep you from harming the child or saying bad or offensive things to the child or trying to, you know, just otherwise affect the child in a negative way. That's where literally you're in a courthouse, you're spending time with the child or at a McDonald's with someone's mom or grandmother watching the situation, and you're not allowed to take the child on your own to the park or to spend the night at your house. And then there's the worst visitation, which is just like no visitation, and I think I talked about that a little bit, you know, before.
So let me ask you about supervised visitation. Who are the supervisors? You mentioned a grandmother, or is it someone from the opposite side of the family? I mean, because this person has to be neutral-minded, I would think, right? Because they have if they see any indiscretions, they see anything that is reported that needs to be reported, that means they have to do a reporting, right? So who does supervise? Is it a professional? Is it another professional? If it is in the community and the environment, do the parties mutually decide? How does that unfold?
Right. Well, kind of like you just touched upon, I mean, that they could have to report. That's a double-edged sword. You know, I've seen litigants, you know, brothers who were ordered to do supervised visitation stay because it was alleged and proven that they had some drug issues or some alcohol issues. And they'd be like, look, I'm out. I'm not doing any supervised visitation. I see the kid when they're 18, storm out of the courtroom, you know. So so that supervised person could be ideally would be say if we're talking about the guy who was getting the supervised visitation, it would be ideally if the young lady had a good relationship with his mother. Like, this guy's bad, but old, you know, Miss Johnson, she was always nice to me, and she's a level-headed person. I know she's not going to let anything happen to her grandchild, So I'm okay as long as she's there, you know. He can even stay overnight, but not to be left alone with you know, with this guy, you know, as long as his mom's there. That's an ideal situation. Well, if the parties, well, the courts always want you to work it out yourself. You know, when you go to court out there in California, New Jersey, New York, they're gonna, you know, a lot of times they're gonna force you into mediation. You know,
a little bit about the mediation, because I was going to ask you about that, because a lot of this type of visitation seems to be the court is the schedule, reasonable, liberal. That seems to be factors that are worked out during mediation. Talk to us a little bit about what that is and why the court wants people to go through that process first.
Right. It's just better for the child. It's better for the parents. You know, they know themselves the best. They can work things. They know what's best for their schedules, for their respective families, how far they have to drive. You don't want some 80-year-old person on a bench making those decisions for you, right? So they're gonna encourage you too to work it out on your own. That doesn't work out, you know. They'll hear preliminarily what's going on, and then they'll send you to what's called mediation. And oftentimes there's a third party mediator there who can just tell you, look, this is what the law says on it, and this is maybe what the judge would decide. So before we get in there and we do all of that, why don't they help guide you, your decisions, and really if you're close to making a decision, they'll try and just force a little bit of a compromise. I mean, sometimes there just is no mediation. Like, I'm moving to Atlanta, I'm out of here, and I'm staying out here in California. So sometimes there's just no middle ground. But mediation is just a process where two people sit down in a room, and here we don't even allow the attorneys to do it, you know, to get involved in that. You know, we just keep it with the litigants. Different jurisdictions do it different ways. Sometimes attorneys are right there in that room, you know, but it's really just the parties trying to talk with an objective third party who really tries to maintain some neutrality, and, you know, just tries to hear both sides and say, well, look, did you ever think about this? It's really a very effective tool, you know, when the people don't just hate each other or just being totally unreasonable, you know? Which is 90% of people. Yeah, go ahead.
So you know what, to jump in, I'm just like, man, this is so much equity in this conversation, you know, because I have not went through any of this, you know. Well, we have five children. Oldest is will be 32 in September. Youngest will be 7 in November. I'm saying that because it's like, you know, growing up in Watts, I'm really closely connected to some of my homeboys started this organization called Project Fatherhood. And in that energy, like everything that you're talking about, Attorney Winkler, it's like, it's so, you know, you could chew on it. It's so soft and it's so strong at the same time. And I just really just wish other men would be exposed to these types of nuggets, because when you spread them across the legal system, that's what intimidated a lot of people. But in an informal conversation like we're having, which is legal education, brother, this is so powerful, and I just want to just give thanks, man. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
Okay, well, I certainly appreciate that, Brother O'Shea. I mean, you know, and that's very gratifying for me to hear stuff like that, man, because, you know, certainly our people, you know, definitely need to hear it, and it's good to be appreciated. And what I'm trying to, like, leave people with is it's not anything to be feared. It's just something to be understood. You got to know your adversary. You got to know, you know, the fight that you're going into. What types of weapons are we going to need? What types of protective gear am I going to need? You know, what are my targets? Just like any fight. And if you go into it with that level of education, that level of preparedness, you know, you gotta fight and shot. But if you go into it just like, I'm just going to go in here, and just do my thing, you know what I mean? And you you know, that's what, where people fall on their faces. And it happens to the young lady, too.
Out.
They going,
yeah.
Oh, you're going to get knocked out.
And it happens to the young lady, too.
They going there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I think that's important because the fathers that I deal with, attorney, they are, and O'Shea, I'm glad you brought up Project Fatherhood. That's an important group. That's out here in California. That's a support group for fathers. And most of the fathers who go there, they're first mandated to go there. It's a support group. I've actually attended several Project Fatherhood meetings, and I had some collaborative work with them. So it's a beautiful organization. One of the things that they try to do, they try to, what you're doing right now very brilliantly, attorney, is to really dispel a lot of the misnomers, and to really quell the fear about going into this process. Because I think a lot of fathers, what happens is a lot of fathers get at the door of this process, and the fears that they have about going into the process, again, as you mentioned, some of those fears are not unfounded, right? Some of those fears are very richly embedded into the American experience. We talk about the legal system and their relationship with the Black community, and in particular, you know, the relationship with Black men from police. Not that Black women don't suffer at equal or intensity, but Black men, their relationship with, you know, police officers and dying at the hands of police officers, and then getting into court and being seen as this foreboding sort of, you know, enemy. And they, when they get in there and they try to express themselves, their passion for their children, it's because of the history, because of how they've been depicted in media and books and just throughout history, they're seen as a threat. So their passion is miscalculated as, you know, as evil or as threatening, and then they get certification to the things that's in the paperwork. But there's justification for the fear, but what you're saying is that, and I think it was brilliant when you brought out the point that you have to educate yourself. You have to go online. You have to read. You have to be prepared when you go in. You have to, and I look at it, you have to codify, you have to, not codify, but drench your mind in understanding of what you're about to go into. Because the more you do that, the more fear goes away, because fear really is based in the unknown, right? So when you don't know
100%.
Something, your fear is exasperated, right? And so like being in the dark. You're like, oh, my God. And then someone switches a light, and you see you're in an amusement park.
Right.
Oh, there's nothing
right.
to do with that, right?
Right.
Do you know what
that's
I'm saying,
right.
Brother O'Shea?
Yeah.
So I really think it's important, that aspect of preparation, and O'Shea, as you said, Project Fatherhood, to look for groups, and you mentioned this too, attorney, to look for groups that are doing this, so you can increase your understanding, you can increase your knowledge, and you can have the support of people who are going through the process as you're going through.
Yeah.
I think that's important. So
right.
I wanted to
touch on something else that you said, you know, about the feelings, you know, that people go up in there, you know, with the, with the intimidation, we have the knowledge and clench balled up, and maybe they are very passionate. If you know it's something you're very passionate about, just do practice one time, you know, talk to someone who you care about, you know, someone you respect, run through your case with them. Maybe they can tell you to dial it back a little bit.
Mm,
and don't go in there scaring
rich.
The judge. Yeah, don't go in there scaring the judge either with a T-shirt on, you know what I mean? You know, with everything.
Yeah.
Like, you got to come with some respect for the court, put on a collared shirt at a minimum, a tie better. Have a little folder, you know what I mean, or something with your papers organized in it. You know, let them know, let this judge know that, look, I am an intelligent person. I am someone who's taking this seriously, and I will file an appeal if there's something outrageous goes on in here. You know what I mean? But if you're just looking like, you know, like I can say anything, do anything to you, and I'll never see you again, you know, that very well could happen. So, you know, you gotta look the part and take it seriously when you walk up in there.
And you know what?
This is so
important.
Powerful. Wow.
Yeah, it is.
No,
so I think,
Okay, go ahead, Mark.
I was saying, were you going to say something, brother? Go ahead, brother.
Yeah, okay. I was just going to say briefly, this is so powerful because what attorney is speaking on is how, you know, that skill set of preparation is transferable. So just with this particular case that you may be going through, a brother or a sister may be going through, like to be prepared for that, them skills that it takes to do that is transferable into every aspect of life. And that's what I think where the rich, the soil is, to just not only just say, okay, I'm going to do this for this case. No, this is how we should be approaching life, you know, prepare.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's brilliant, because once you go through the process is not just germane to that event, right? The process is the process, so it is transferable. So
yeah,
you can do this, but then you have a big project that you're working on. So it's the preparation, it's the articulation, it's the presentation of yourself and how you articulate your ideas. And I think it's important. Attorney, what you said, Winkler, what you said about practicing your presentation before you go into court. And I just want to say to the fathers that are listening that doesn't mean you have, that's not a sellout move. You're not selling out. You're not changing who you are. What you're doing is you're presenting your best self to the court. You're presenting to the court a projection of character. And what you're saying to court is, I don't know what what is it called, attorney, the petitioner and the respondent, right? So
for
instance, they didn't get in first, and now they're the respondent. So what they're saying to the court is, I don't know what, I see what the petitioner put in their documentation, but that's not me. This is who I am. And this is the person that I'm saying should be in the best interest of the child, as you mentioned, which is very important to keep that in the forefront of the court's mind. This is who I am, right? So when the court is looking at the person in front of them, they don't get validation that, well, that person is the same person I see in this manila folder. That person's a psycho.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to let that person in a child's life. So as we move towards 18 minutes of closing, and I do want to get through some things that I want to talk about. So let's talk a little bit about custody determinations. You touched on some of them, but let's go through and talk about what determines custody in these type of scenarios.
Okay. Well, we'll get more into the child custody factors, but I just got to backtrack, man. You mentioned the roles, petitioner and respondent, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's key. You know, the petitioner goes first. I love being a petitioner. You get a chance. The court say, it's your case, proceed. You get a chance to jump out there and lay a foundation, to paint the picture, you know, to just, you know, basically just to draw the landscape. It's great to be the petitioner. You don't have to say, he ain't nothing and he's nothing and he's never going to be nothing. You know, now I'm coming back and I'm trying to show I'm nothing. But if I had simply filed first,
One, it
shows the initiative. I took the initiative to come get my child, you know what I mean? And two, it allows me to get out there first. And once I get out there first, it's over. It's like, you know, I'm going to run with it, you know? And it's kind of like a fight, O'Shea. Like, hey, if I get to punch you in the face first, guess what?
Right.
You know, you might not get up, you know?
Right.
You want to be the petitioner, fellas. You know, get out there. You be the one to file. Don't wait. Don't be that responder who's getting dragged into court. Try to be the one who initiates the case. Okay, a lot of strategy behind that. So yeah. So what goes into that that chat? Let's look at those child custody factors a little bit more and examine how some of that can come into play. You also have to look at, are there siblings involved? You know, you may want to come say, I want to take my child, but guess what? He's got four brothers and sisters. You know what I mean? You just going to break that up, you know? So that can jam you up right there, you know? And these are some of the things that you know, that their brothers do suffer from on these things, you know? You're going to look at, we talked about the employment responsibilities, This is a very, very important factor on the East Coast, and it's got to be on the West Coast as well, is where they talk about which parent is likely to foster a good relationship between the child and the other parent. Which one is going to be better at that? If I'm coming to court with a bunch of texts saying, look, I know it's not my weekend, but look, it's my mom's birthday. Could you just let me come? No, it is your weekend or whatever, you know what I mean? The court's going to say, look, here's a person who's not going to compromise, you know what I mean? Who's not going to work. And look, when is the child's play? You know, what are his grades like? And, like, I'm not telling you anything. You need to pay your child support, you know? Like, these things are going to be factors that the court's going to look at. Which one is more likely to say, you know, like, look, you know, look, the kids didn't want to come see you, but I put them in a car anyway, which is what you're supposed to do, you know, with a young kid. Mm. You have to say, look, no, that's your dad, that's your mom. You got to go see her, you know. So that's an important fact, which one is, you know, and I always tell people, you know, when we're in the middle, if nothing else, when we're in the middle of this case, you got to kill them with kindness, you know. I don't want to see any ignorant texts. You ain't nothing, and you're killing yourself. You know, you gotta know that you're in a court case. I mean, just at least if you can't contain yourself and act civil for this period of time, you know what I mean? You played yourself, you know. And please don't text ignorant, crazy stuff to people. That stuff stays. You can delete it. It stays there forever and ever and ever. It just doesn't matter. Text crazy, you know what I mean? So that's a big problem. The quality and continuity of the child's education, like, you know, if they're in a school, they're established, they got friends, they got teachers that know them, they're doing well, that's called a nice status quo. Courts don't like to mess with that. You know, they say if it ain't broke, don't fix it, kind of like that, you know. So that's going to be a very important factor, the stability of each parent's home environment. Is grandmom around to maybe help out as a parental resource, you know, as a resource, you know. These things are important. We talked about if the child has special needs at all, you know. Safety of the child, you know, if you're having like a bad household, you've got bad households out here. You know what I mean? You got guys who go in and say, look, mom's in the middle of the project. She got this thug up in here who's acting a fool and everything like that. I want to get my kid away from that, you know. So the stability of that household is going to be important, right. You know.
That's definitely a factor. But let me ask you this, because I think some people on that point, attorney, may confuse scarcity of resources with a bad environment. So if I'm poor, that doesn't mean that I have a bad environment. So talk about that, because some people may feel, based upon what you're saying, if they are indigent in some way, that's a presentation of a bad household.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to straighten that out. Nothing wrong with being with being, you know, and most of our people come from humble origins. So I'm not saying that just because one lives in a project, they live in subsidized housing, that they can't have a good life. You know, I'm talking about the situation where, you know, you're in a bad environment and you're living that baby boy life. You know what I mean? You know, where you got, you know, you got dude who's up in the household. He's beating on mommy, and you know he's, you know, and they're not acting right. You know, these are the situations where those stereotypical, you know, more stereotypical images that we see amongst some of our peoples with the you know, who are forced into a lower, just a bad living environment, man. You know that comes out. You know, that's going to come into play, especially if the other person is in a much better position to give the child a better life. I mean, and it does sadly come down to economics sometimes, but. You know, sometimes, you know, if that other, you know, you can be in a project, you're doing well in school and all that, and that'll offset those things. But if you're down there, you know, and you've got some rough things going on, and the child's getting jumped into a gang and this and that, you know, that's not going to work, you know. So they're going to use that against you.
Right. So just to be clear, what I'm hearing is even if you were in an environment that, say, for instance, one parent is living in a very opulent lifestyle and you're living in a more, you know, a economically scarce lifestyle, but you're keeping all the elements, negative elements or elements that sometimes we find in that environment, you're keeping it away from the child. You can get a good custody arrangement.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I've seen women kick guys behinds like that. I mean, this guy, he's got, I mean, she may not be doing well, but she's keeping those kids in the house. They're up in church groups. They're in community groups. They're doing well in school. And this guy's like, well, she's not doing anything for herself, and he's just a little hood thing. But she's taking care of, she's holding it down. She's taking care of those kids and stuff like that. Right. Give her some more damn child support if you want to see your kids living better, is what the judge was saying. You know what I mean? So, you know what I mean? So,
Thank you for that example, because I was just about to ask you for an example. And right when I was about to say it, you gave me one. That's perfect.
Right. So there's nothing wrong with being broke if you're holding it down. I just said that, you know, just because, you know, sometimes, you know, we do face some extraordinary challenges in the hood. That's what it is, you know. So
right. But I think and I appreciate you fleshing that out, because I don't want people to think that their circumstances would prevent them from being a parent. Right. I want them to feel confident about going into court no matter what their circumstances are. Okay,
so as you move to
closing out this portion. More, talk a little bit about attorney, the changing custody. What constitutes or what a person could, when they have a, what is that? Changing custody, changing the circumstances. Talk about that. What circumstances would constitute a change in custody orders?
Right. That was the comparison that drew to being on a level battlefield to someone throwing rocks down at you. When you're coming in trying to change custody, you know, when someone's established a status quo and things are going right, you don't even get to trial. You don't even get you file your motion and everything. You don't even get to trial unless the judge says you've established a change in circumstances. Like, but you could say like, but she works 12 hours a day. So what? She's always been working 12 hours a day. You know what I mean? Mm. It's not going to make, you know, well, she smokes weed. Well, she was smoking weed back then. You know what I mean? When you were with her. But the change would be things like, you know, like, okay, now it's different. You know, she's in here with this guy. He's a damn molester. I don't want him around my daughter. You know what I mean? Or she got a new job. Now she's doing overnight. She's sleeping all day and the kids are going wild. You know what I mean? That's not going to work, you know? Changing circumstances can be like, you know, or maybe that was great when they were living over there. Now they don't live. Now they're over here now. They're in this WAC school district and you know, the child's feeling out now. Or the child's not attending class anymore. Like, they got 100 absences and a $250 count, a 250-day count a year. It's got to be something that's going to be a change from what's went on. It can't be a minor change, like the grade is slipping a little bit. I've seen people tossed out of court and just with their hopes that the boy wants to be with me now. He's 14 now, and that means like automatically he needs a dad around. That old argument. That's, you know, a lot of times that falls
like
their
baby
beard.
Boy.
You
know,
like, what I mean?
He's a young man. He's going to come with me now.
Right, yeah. You ain't going to do it on just that, you know? You got to really, I don't want to totally poo-poo that. If you are going to do that, you got to come to court with a child custody expert. You know, they're people that you hire who come in and they go through home visits to both households. They're going to do a psychological testing of the child and the parents. They're going to talk to family members and neighbors. We're important. They're going to really dig into the weeds, and they're going to render a report to the court and say who should be the best father, the best parent, you know?
So now you're talking about custody evaluations, right?
You're spending money, too. That's like
$6,000 to $8,000 to $10,000,
you know?
So that's on the parents?
Yeah.
So the court
is an expert.
So okay,
Okay. Yeah, the court, they'll do sometimes a best interest evaluation in some jurisdictions, or, you know, or fortunately if DIFAS is involved, you know, or I don't, you know, they have mm-hmm. different names in different parts of the country, they'll do their own evaluations. And, you know, once
yeah,
they're involved.
Department of Children and Family Services out here, but I think everyone knows what DIFAS is. So.
Yeah, right. Once they're involved, it's a whole different ball game, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
Attorney,
well,
you've given us so much information here. I really hope that anyone who's going through this got a chance to hear this. We're going to reshare it. We're going to put it out there again. I really hope people got a chance to hear it and really got it to hear it with an open mind and not a closed mind.
Right.
One of the things that when I was going through this situation, I was very candid about it. I actually wrote a book about it. One of the things that I did, I had to eliminate people who spoke negatively to me, right? And when mm-hmm. I say eliminated, I didn't mean put them out of my life. I just meant put them out of this conversation because
right.
I had a limited amount of real estate I was dealing with in my mind about this in life in general, but about this particular situation. And I had to make certain that information that was coming into me, right, that it would feed me in a way that inspired my energy and not deflate my energy or not exasperate my energy towards anger. Because it's
right.
very difficult when you're going in front of the court, if you have all of that on your spirit, all of that energy in you, it's almost impossible not to translate that and what you're saying to the court. And so
mm-hmm.
I encourage people to hear what you heard today with an open mind and a mind free of anything that would lead you to want to go into this trying to destroy the mother or destroy the father, whatever the case may be, and really looking at the best interest of the child. So as we enter towards our closeout, attorney, are there anything that you would like to share, any main point that you would like people who are about to go into this process to really take with them? Any particular one particular takeaway that you would like, or a couple of particular takeaways?
Yeah, I would say the single most important thing is to go in there prepared, do some research on what it takes to win that case. The internet is your friend. You can just get all mm-hmm. kinds of information from there. Dress appropriately. And be respectful to that court. If you get into an argument with the judge, it's not going to work out well for you, you know. So just be respectful of that judge. It's their house, you know. You don't have to necessarily, you know, back down, but you want to definitely, you know, be very even tone with that court. You know, be respectful. Don't get into a back and forth with the court. It's not gonna end up well for you. And if at all possible, you know, try to retain competent counsel. Caring, competent counsel, you know, to go in there with you so that you can put your best foot forward. It's a once in a lifetime. It's the most important, one of the most important things you're going to do in your life, custody of your kids. So, you know, do it right.
And caring, competent representation. Caring.
That's right.
I would highlight
yep.
that, right? Because there's a lot of people who are competent, but if they are
mm-hmm.
just, if you get a sense that they don't care about what you're
yep.
about to
can't,
go into.
Can't get them on the phone. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Keep looking. Because this is not
right.
the court where someone is being assigned to you. Like you mentioned, DIFAS,
nah.
the Department of Children and Family Services. You're actually paying for someone's services. So you want to make sure whoever you're paying for, that they're going in there with the same spirit and energy that you at least
mm-hmm.
somewhat of the same spirit and energy that you are going in there with. And that's to make sure that the child stays in your life. So,
that's right.
So I told you to go back quick, right, Attorney Winkler?
Yeah, that time flew. That was 9:50 a minute ago. Yeah,
wow. Man, this is so rich. This is so powerful, Attorney Winkler. Man, I personally so appreciate again, man, the work, the energy, man, and you know, onward and upward, man. Great information.
I just can't leave them on the show. I check it out sometimes, and I'm like, no, I'm one of the guys. You guys keep doing the good work, you know?
Yes. Thank
keep
you very much. Thank you
yeah.
for joining us, Attorney Winkler, on the other side. We really appreciate you.
All All right. All right, gentlemen. Have a good evening.
All right.
Take care.
You're welcome. Now, bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break to make to do a station announcement, and then we're going to come back with more on the other side with Mark and O'Shea. So stay tuned.
You're listening to E-Water Radio, KEWRDB.
The views and comments expressed do not reflect the opinions of E-Water Radio. All comments and views are show guest views and comments and in no way reflect views or comments of E-Water Radio, KEWRDB, or its affiliates.
We're back on the other side. O'Shea, was that a lot of rich information we just got there, brother?
Brother, that was so rich, man. I just could feel brothers jumping up and down because, you know, the way he laid the information out in a way he just encouraged brothers not to be, you know, frightened, not to be intimidated. It's just a process, mm-hmm. and the more you know is the more you can grow through this process. So, yeah, that was great stuff, brother.
I love that, brother. The more you know is the more you can grow. That's actually a good segue, because what we want to do in this next hour or so is we get a lot of people are shy to call in, but a lot of people, they send us questions and comments. Mm-hmm. So we want to look at a few of those. We want to answer some questions, and we want to help people to know more so we can all grow together. So for the next hour, we're going to entertain questions that have come in. So, brother, I am going to start, and I'm going to throw it out, but we're going to look at some questions, brother. So the first question is, brother, came from an episode that we talked about, and I think the question really came from something you talked about, brother, when you talked about the things that your mother was going through and the struggle that she had. And one of the questions was, what are the steps to create a collaborative environment for mental health resources using the extended community, extended family? You know, how can they activate that more? So I'm going to throw that question to you first, brother, because that's something you went through, and I believe that you and your wife, you are creating a collaborative environment. So why don't you tackle that one, brother?
Yeah, absolutely, man. That's such a huge question, and it's so necessary, because oftentimes when you are going, when one is going through that type of a situation, they're not able to, you know, articulate the resources that will aid them and to, you know, assist them in that type of energy. But one of the things that's very important is for us to be able to be mindful to move through this energy with us being so at ease, right? Like, you don't have to stir up this power inside of people, because if someone is having mental health issues, you have to nourish that. You have to pour into that. You have to be open to how they're showing up. And I feel that in the case of my mother, you know, the way she was showing up, so many people did not know that she was actually a genius, and she just really got tired and fed up with how life was treating her. So with that energy, I'm just so you know, able to articulate, because I saw my mother go through it, how necessary it is for us to cultivate communities of healing, safe spaces to be able to shed light on these issues. There's nothing wrong with someone that's having mental health. They're not evil. They're not dirty people. It's just an imbalance. And when you're looking at it from a place where they are imbalanced, and what makes them more balanced, you can offer that. But to answer your question specifically, you know, I feel that, you know, there's groups that's dealing with balance. My wife and I, we wrote a book called Internal Balance, What You Marry You, and the book is centered in how to balance your mind, body, and spirit. So when we're dealing with mental health, that's one aspect of it. But what about the body? What about the spirit? So those are should be working harmoniously with each other. And if they're not, you know, you and me could be mentally unstable, Mark. Like, you know, I remember, like, I had a sister that told me about 15 years ago. She was like, you know, because of what we went through as children, we're a little crazy. And she said, she told me, she said, and brother, you have a way of, you know, hiding your insanity. Right, and she laid it out for me, and I had to really consider her vantage, right? And I just really, I sat with it, and I was like, wow, you're absolutely right. Like, you know, one can go through so much to where they become numb to what threw them off track. So just to bring it full circle, brother, yes, there are groups that will assist in that energy. My wife and I, we do that work extensively. And if anyone needs resources to complement a family member, a friend, or someone they know that's going through this, absolutely, we can be reached, right, at internalbalanceintensive.com. That's www.internalbalanceintensive.com, and we'll be happy to answer any questions and offer whatever resources we have to that energy.
You know what? And hearing you, brother, I think there's a couple of things that really stuck out. One is normalize it, right? Because if we're dealing with society issues that we deal with every day, right? There, I think at any given point, if you check in with people at a particular moment, you may say, "Oh, that person, something's wrong with that person." And they just may be going through a particular phase.
Right.
But there's some people who get stuck in those phases.
Right?
But that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with them. It just means that they need help to get out of that phase. So I really love when you say you normalize it, because then you help them to see. Because I think most people, because they don't have that community, they don't have the internal balance support that you're speaking of. And I really hope everyone, of course, this will be, we share this. We're going to repurpose it on the podcast platforms. The information that O'Shea just dropped in terms of being able to contact and to get the resources, I hope that people can reach out if they're going through this, because these are normal occurrences that happen. And if you find yourself unable to get out of it, then it's important, as you're saying, to reach out and not feel as if there's something wrong with you. Because I think people get stuck and they get, I guess for lack of a word, they get ashamed to talk about it. Would you agree with that?
Right. Man, I would totally agree with that, man, because shame is, you know, like it's relative, right? A person will automatically feel that and, again, don't know what to do with that energy, and they'll just close themselves off to resources, right? But when one can be just open and, you know, as y'all were saying even earlier, we were talking about authentic with our expression of where we are, and then just be and just get prepared. I feel that it's very important for us to get prepared in these times coming off of 2020. I don't know nobody that's sane right now. You know, how can you be sane right now coming off of 2020? So everybody that's listening is mentally off balance, and if you're not, that if you think you're not, that means you really are.
That's beautiful, brother. That's rich.
So I do have someone that had reached out to me, and this question is directed to you. You know, like a brother, he actually has a daughter, and he had ordered your book, you know, My Daughter's Keeper, right? And he had wanted to know. He said, "Man, how do you go about writing a book about your daughter and the things you went through. What was the first steps? I was like, bro, I haven't wrote a book about my daughter, but that was my brother, the co-host, Mark's book. So I'm going to pose that question to you, brother. What were those steps for the brother? How did you just sit down and have the discipline to carve out a book, brother, about your daughter and about some of the things you were going through?
I think whoever sent that question is, you know what? I think the first thing I had to do I had to get a little distance from the situation, right? So I didn't write it right after I was going through it, right? I didn't write it while I was still full of the emotionality of the moment, right? Mm-hmm. So I had to sit with the emotions that I was going through. Then mm-hmm. I had to think about, you know, how I felt each moment or each phase of the events that I went through mm-hmm. towards this journey, like this journey into Oz, if you will. I had to think about how I felt when I got the call from the Department of Children and Family Services, what that mm-hmm. meant to me.
Yes.
Did that mean I was a bad father? Did it mean that I was going to lose contact with my daughter forever? Right, so there was so many emotional sort of roller coasters I was on through this process. When I got off that roller coaster, when I finally got the blessings of getting custody of my daughter, I was still on edge.
Mm.
I was very sort of dogmatic in my approach to parenting. I didn't want certain things around me. If my family members did certain thing that I thought, because my daughter was still young, and if she would hear right. something and then take something back to the court, because there was still some follow-up stuff that had to happen, I didn't want anything around. I was very strict and constricted. And I stayed in that mold for a while. And in that mold, I couldn't write. And I couldn't write about it because I was still going through it. So I had to separate from the emotionality of it. And when I felt I was at ease, Brother O'Shea, I felt like I was comfortable enough to write, I started to write. Right. Mm. And it's funny you mentioned that, because someone wrote about, and you can actually veggie back, as you say, on this, because the question was, you know, how do you get started writing a book or writing, right? So mm-hmm, I want you to veggie mm-hmm. back on that part. But specifically about my daughter, when I started to write, I had to write from a space of, one, what got me there?
Yes.
And I had to be very honest, and I could not write from a blame or shame perspective about these are the things that this mother did to me and it put me in this situation, and I had to fight through, and it was nothing about me that was wrong. I first had to be very, I had to do a radical sort of evaluation of myself, and I had to write about what got me in this situation, what put me in this moment, right? Because I contributed to that atmosphere,
right?
So because it wasn't just the mother. The mother initiated the action, but there was something that precipitated that. So I am honest about my participation in the creation of the atmosphere that put our daughter in a situation that she was being parented by two unhappy parents. So I wrote about that, brother. And then I was very sensitive about when my daughter's old enough to read this book, I wanted her to not read a book about her father dogging her mother. So I was very careful to not put my feelings in there, how I felt going through the situation.
Right.
I talked about what got me out of those moments, right? The things I did to help me not stay in that mindset. So really the two things, one, I separated from the emotionality of it, and then I was very honest about what I did to contribute. And there was so much there to write about, right? I was able to write from my feelings from a person now on the outside looking at that person who I was no longer that person.
Right.
I've no longer felt like I had to constrict my environment to make sure that I didn't lose my daughter. Right. Because now I feel there's nothing that can separate me from my daughter. Nothing.
Wow.
Even if she goes to live full time with her mother, my relationship with my daughter is cemented. Does that make sense, brother?
Mm. Man, that makes so much sense. That's so rich, brother. That's so rich, man. The brother name is Carl. The brother name is Carl Anderson that asked that question. So, Carl, wherever you are, brother, man, I hope that, you know what I'm saying, that suffice, because it was so rich, and I appreciate the way you articulated that, Mark, and especially separating yourself from the emotionality of the energy, mm-hmm. and you had to wait till you moved through it until you wrote about it. Like, but to write yes. while you're in the energy, oftentimes that writing can be biased. It can lean on emotions, right? So, mm-hmm. man, that was so, so rich, man. Yeah, that
Thank
was
you,
rich, man. So, yeah, whoo, that was powerful. So,
My Daughter's Keeper. Yeah. You can get it on Amazon.
My Daughter's Keeper. Yes, My Daughter's Keeper. Absolutely, man. So the veggie back off of what you said in terms of writing the book, is that the question?
Yeah, so someone wrote, actually someone out of Illinois, brother, how do you get started writing? Because they mentioned eternal balance. They mentioned My Daughter's Keeper.
Yes.
They want to write, brother. They just want to know, how do you get started, man? What's the process? How should they start their journey?
Yes. First, you have to know, not believe, but just know that you are worthy, validated, and more than enough. And your story is spiritual equity for a depreciating planet, right? So you just know that. Like, so, and then it's very important for us to have stories, right? Our story, mm-hmm. going back to the griot, you know, that's where we get the form storytelling from. You know, the great African griot would pass down the history, the culture, the tradition of a people, of a culture, orally, right? So these oral stories will get translated, and through that translation, that's how we get a lot of things even today. What great-great-grandma said, or great-great-grandpa said, but the significance of telling your own story is that you don't have to worry about someone else holding the pen to your story. So once you know that you are validated, worthy, and more than enough, and then you can sit down and you can deal with it, right? But first you have to, as Attorney Winkler was saying on the previous hour, get prepared. Like, and these are ways to get mentally prepared to deal with your story. And once you're able to sit down and breathe, and then you can go through what story you want to tell, right? Because we all have slices of life, as Father Amir,
yes.
the Wise Prophets would say. So in those slices of life, you know, some are pizza slices, some are cake slices, some are, ooh, I don't want to say what type of slice, but they're slices, right? So, but when you get ready to deal with a slice of your life, deal with it. And I would say start off by writing without editing, just getting it out of you, right? So whatever that is, a lot of people may start off journaling. A lot of people out there may already journal, and them journals can be kind of reimagined into books, into memoirs, into all types of manuscripts. So I'm saying that today in 2021, it is so simple to write a book. It's not easy, oh no, but it's very simple because we have tools available to us that were not available 10, 15, 20 years ago, right? 20 years ago, you would have to search out a main big publisher, and they'll, you know, turn you down or whatever have you, and you'll be waiting for a response for them. But right now, we're in an age to whereas someone say, how do I write a book? Okay, if you don't quote-unquote write every day, because writers write. That's number one. Right. If you're going to write about the contents of what's in your purse, if you're a woman, or you the contents of what's in whatever, just write. Writers write. But if you are intimidated from the writing process, going back to those tools, you can literally sit down somewhere and on your smartphone, story out. And they have apps that will transcribe your story into Word document form. And from that transcription, you are then able to go back and read over what you said and then make little slight adjustments. But my number one thing for any emerging writer or person that is inspiring to be an author, to get your story as solid as possible. Get the content ready. And what that means, have it in Word document. Have it, you know, the chapters lined out. And then whatever books writers also read. So be sure if you want to write a book, you read books, right? Because through reading books, you're able to see the different styles and the energy of the people who you say, oh, yeah, I like this. And then you can literally not copy them, but you can use that as a template, right, to just insert your story. And that's what it's about. We got tools available for us that's plug and play that we did not have 20 years from now. So I just encourage people, do not leave Earth without telling your story.
I think that's so important, Mac. I love two things you said. You said, one, you said write without editing, right? So that just means start the process, right? And don't worry about punctuation. Don't worry about these other things because, as you said, there's all of these existing tools to help to perfect the document once you've finished writing the document. And then to just know that you have a story, and your story is worth telling. Because everything that we see on television is either some fictionalized story, some exaggerated story, and the emerging sort of trend is to tell true stories. And if we look at our lives, there's so many points in our lives that we probably said, oh, man, what I just went through would make a good movie, or what I went through would make a good book. But they just say that, and then they walk away from the moment and not realizing that, yes, that would make a good movie, but what would make a good movie about it? Not just that it was exciting or there was some scary moments or it was exciting. It was the fact that there was this process that you went through that was a human experience that you learned something from or you didn't learn something from or that gave you some growth. And that's a story worth sharing. That's a story worth putting out there so other people can learn, can grow, can laugh, can cry, can have an experience similar to what you had in that experience that you went through. So that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I hope whoever wrote that, asked that question, will just take the two takeaways that I got from what you just brilliantly said, brother, was that, one, know your story is important enough to write. And secondly, start writing without editing. Don't edit your thoughts. Don't edit your tendency to write certain things down. Don't think, well, should I?
Man, you on, brother. You on. And then because you know the magic is in the editing. So if you just get the content together, you know, there are people who you can bring on board that will edit, that will format, that will put all the bells and whistles on it. But right now, you just need to get and gather the content. That's very important. So, yeah, great, great, great question, man. You know, I have one for you, brother, man. I have a question that it was interesting. Someone, this is on our, you know, a few episodes ago where you had kind of stressed out the term radicalized masculinity. So, you know, this brother reached out via email, and he just was like, brother, the term that your co-host Mark said, radicalized masculinity, where did that come from? Did he coin that? And then he asked, so it's a two-part question. The second part is, was that a term to kind of counter, act as a counter to toxic masculinity? Can you speak to that, man? The brother's name is Pat. Pat,
that's a brilliant question. I'm glad glad you asked that. It was a counter, but it was an expansion, right? Because when I kept hearing the term toxic masculinity, right? And as I heard the term more, I looked at what the term was doing in the environment. And the term was actually creating division in the environment because men particularly, as they heard the term toxic masculinity, they started to counter and fight back and say, well, masculinity is not toxic. There's nothing wrong with being masculine. There's nothing wrong with being a man. And they lost the meaning, not the meaning, but they lost the intent behind the statement. The intent behind the statement was to say that there is elements of masculinity that has caused problems in the community. Toxic. Those elements introduced into the environment is like introducing negative food into your system. And eventually your system, your body rejects or it breaks down. It no longer functions properly because of these toxins in your body. But that is a symptom, I said. I said that toxic masculinity is a symptom and it's not the cause. So I wanted to find, I wanted to get a term, brother, that more aptly captured the cause of toxicity in the environment versus the toxicity. Because when you go to the doctor and you have a pain in your body someplace, right? If the doctor only looks at the symptoms and they only treat the symptoms, they give you medicine to stop the aching in your arm, or if you're having chest issues and they give you medicine to stop the aching, but they don't look at the source, eventually that source will either cause a complete cessation of life, or it will severely disable you in a normalized way, right? So radicalized masculinity, to me, more aptly captured what this dynamic was. And how I thought about that was I looked at the political environment starting around 2000, right?
Okay.
And I said that between the elections of 2000, then 2004, then 2008, there seemed to be, you know, people in both sides who were, you know, it wasn't this sort of great schism that we have right now, right? But around 2008, after the election of Obama, there was a radicalization of political thought. People started to get more entrenched in their positions. Now, there was a lot of progress to that, right? You talked about the advent and this and the widespread of social media,
right,
and us getting, you know, trapped in these silos that we're in, the advent of the Tea Party and the, you know, people on the right and the left just getting entrenched in their thinking, and people began to get radicalized in their thoughts. So I said, that's what happened to masculinity. I believe masculinity at its core, brother, it's compassionate. It's loving.
Yes.
All of these values, all of these things that happen, and that's not a bad thing, but because it was radicalized over the centuries, right, what we got was, and what we have is the idea that to be masculine is to be forceful. To be masculine.
Speak on it, yes.
Right. To be masculine is to be have a sense of entitlement. And with that sense of entitlement, but people take that and they and that sense of entitlement spread, it bleeds into so many different elements of our life. Right. And the reinforcement of that ideal of masculinity starts very young. Very young, brother. It starts at, you know, when kids are, you know, just 6 and 7. You know, don't cry.
Right.
If you're a boy, man up. You get hurt, man up.
You
don't cry for 10 seconds and then stop all that crying. Boy, you a man. You ain't no woman.
Right.
As if to say, that's saying that if you cry, if that you're a woman, that's saying that then women are weak. Right? So you have to take, you have to flush those thoughts out, right? So those are toxic thinking. And also that radicalized understanding of masculinity causes men not to connect to one another. I'm not going to get close to this guy because getting close to this guy means that maybe I'm gay, right? I'm going to figure it out on my own. I'm not going to, you know, I'll talk to this guy about sports and whatever, but I'm not going to express what's deeply hurting me. Something's going wrong with my home, but I'm going to keep that bottled up. And the painful thing is this radicalized masculinity. It's not just perpetuated by men, because women were under the same understanding of masculinity, right? So they, especially single women. A great book I'm reading by DeAndre Whitfield, Male versus Man, he talks about single women. When the man leaves the home, whether he leaves the home because of circumstances or he may die, the woman says, "You're the man of the house now." This kid can be 10 years old. What does he know
right,
about manhood?
Right, right,
where does he
right.
get the examples of manhood? He gets it maybe from television. He gets it on the schoolyard. So it was radicalized, brother. And the result of the radicalization was the toxicity that we see. So I wanted to stop thinking. I wanted the conversation to move away from men thinking that we're saying that masculinity is toxic versus that it has something that's happened to it that we need to have a conversation around.
Man, that's so powerful, man. And the way you stressed that out, man, oh, my God. Like, that was so powerful, man. Indeed. Patrick Armstead is his name. So, yeah, the brother that asked that question, man. That was powerful, Patrick. Mark, and I appreciate how you stressed that out, man.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. But I have a question for you. I appreciate you. I only gathered the states, brother. Brother out of Chicago, he wrote, "I noticed he's been having feelings of increased anxiety around going back out. Now, going back out, now that things are being relaxed, right? Now that COVID is, the numbers are still, you know, they're not like skyrocketing, but the numbers are starting to decrease around the country with the vaccines and people adhering a little bit more in certain serious pockets of people, areas where people are adhering to some of the mandates, mask and distancing. But his question is, he wants to feel okay about going back out, but he feels still very anxious about it. There's a lot of anxiety about trying to start living normal again. Or having some sense of normality. Talk to him a little bit, brother. Talk to that person.
Yeah, so first off, the anxiety, them emotions are energy and motion. So I would say not to ignore that, right? Because we are all, again, coming out of 2020. We are, you know, many of us are off balance. So now with the stay-at-home orders and all of these things are lifted, now it's like, so now what do I do? So I would say it's going to be very important for you to, that environment that you have cultivated in your home, whether it's, you know, making your home a space, a safe space where you can spend the majority of your time. And I would say continue to do that because our home is truly our castle. And I feel that many people should not rush back out and begin to do things pre-COVID, right? Like we really should just take our time and ease back out there here and there. So I would say one of the things that we can do until we go out fully again is to create beautiful experiences with, you know, your loved ones, whether they are, you know, maybe you have a auntie that stays 20 minutes from you, you know, speak to her and talk to one of your cousins, and then only family, y'all meet up at the park for a sun gathering, right? That's beautiful. So you're coming together to gather in the energy of the sun, and then each household would bring their own thing to eat. It still would be a safe distance apart, and you all would just be able to soak in the sun and have conversation, have a little Bluetooth speaker, and just do that. Put that on the calendar. So I say when you first start with your family, maybe the brother is not single and he has a family at home, start going out with them and having sun gatherings, and then reach out to your quote-unquote extended family, and then that's how you ease back into the energy of society, right? Because to just go back out like it's everything is cool now, that's not the approach that I would suggest that the brother have, you know. But then sit with that anxiety, them angst, that feeling. But one of the things you can do in terms of counteracting that is drinking water with a lemon squeeze, meditating, right? Like a lot of brothers, when we come together and just be still and meditate, that's so, so powerful for us, right? And then another thing, affirmation. So all of these things will help in decreasing anxiety, right? So I feel that we should create rituals in our home. And how do you create a ritual in your home? Your ritual would be from when you rise in the early moments. I don't call it morning because we don't mourn in the morning, you know, but when we rise in the early moments, we can then do something. Maybe you want to write down the dream that you had. Maybe you want to then deal with reading a book for 10 minutes. Maybe you want to then read affirmations. You know, get yourself in this mood of victory, right? You know, think about what a victorious person would do when they rise every moment, right? They have certain things that they do, but I feel that brothers, sisters, people of the world, we should do these in our homes, and then we will not be affected by anxiety because we would be creating an environment, and then when we go out into the world, we take that environment with us. And last but not least, everybody that interacts with us in society, they will feel that energy that we are vibrating on.
I love that, brother. That was so rich. You talked to. I love the fact that it's ideal of easing back into it. There's a stage process, right? The sun gatherings. I love that. You start with your immediate, right? You go down the street to your aunt, your grandmother, and you get out. I mean, because now the weather's breaking around the country now, so you can have these sun gatherings, and I think. Start with the immediate family is so beautiful, man. Then you start, and then you expand from that nucleus to the extended, right? We're going to a little science. You bring in your circles, man. And I think that is important. And doing that, you know, especially if you're anxious about getting the virus or you haven't got your vaccine, you choose not to get the vaccine, but you still want to live in a way that keeps that virus away from you. Just, hey, talk to the people who you're talking about bringing in and ask them, you know, have you been doing the right thing? Because I want to invite you over, but I need to know that you've been living a certain way that you're not going to negatively impact this little small circle I want to bring you in, right? And I would say, brother, I think a lot of people may feel anxious about asking, you know, their friends and family that question, but I think in this dynamic in this situation, in this moment, as you said, I think we should sort of dispel any anxiety we have about asking people, have you been taking care of yourself, right? Yeah. Have you been doing, being responsible, right? Because that's not saying I don't want to be around you. That's just saying I want you to be around me, but I want to know that I'm safe and you're safe. So I think people don't feel uncomfortable about having those type of conversations. And it's beautiful, man, to bring in that. And I love, you know, the idea of and that's another question I'm gonna get to in a second, but you spoke on it a little bit about fortifying, you know, your mind and to keep the anxiety at a low level. You know, some of the things that you said when you wake up in the early moments. That was brilliant, right? How you don't just jump into it. Don't just jump into the news, right? Don't pick up social media first. Pick up something that's going to help to decrease your anxiety. That's going to exasperate your anxiety.
Come on, brother. Come on, brother. Man, this is good, man. This is so good, man. I do have a blanket your question, man. A sister has. She reached out, and the sister said, and I'm just going to just put it on the table. The sister reached out, and the sister said she's raising 3 young boys, right, 7, 9, and 13. And she said that where she's living, she don't have any examples of, quote-unquote, masculinity or manhood or like she don't have, you know, their father – is not in their life for whatever reason, mm-hmm. but she just was mm-hmm. expressing how, you know, she loved to listen to the show, but she wanted to mm-hmm. know that for her, you know, what does she do if she's, you know, don't have a masculine presence in her son's life?
I think the first thing, brother, and we talk about this a lot, is we have to think community. Right. We have to think, because I think what happens is especially because we've been over the past year, we've been really isolated from the community. So that's not the first thought that may come to mind is community. Right. So there are males in our lives. There's positive male figures in our lives. That person may be a coach. Person may be a counselor, a school counselor. That person may be an uncle, a brother or uncle who she didn't necessarily connect with that much, but who is a positive person who's doing positive things. So make a list of all the men that you know in your life who are doing positive yeah. things, who's thinking in the way that you want your son to think, and then start wow. making connections with that person and start building community, because it takes a village. Right. And so yes. we moved away from that philosophy. Right, brother. We moved away from the philosophy of reaching out to the community. And we think immediate. We think I don't have a boyfriend. I don't have a husband. You know,
right.
I don't have any siblings. But then there's so the once you start thinking community, then you start
wow.
thinking, well, wait a second. I know this person.
Mm-hmm.
I know this person.
Yeah.
Then start. If you can't think of anyone, reach out to people who you trust. You say, well, who do you know? You know,
right.
because and also
right.
start looking at organizations. If you can't think of
yes.
anyone that you know, start looking at organizations in your area. We're both in California, but there's an organization out here. Well, actually, it's a nationwide organization called 100 Black Men. That's a nationwide organization, and so you can connect them to those organizations, fraternities that do work with young men. Right, so
yes.
you have to begin to expand your ideas of who you can connect to. Right,
wow.
so I think, brother, and you and your wife do some brilliant work with the idea of connecting to the community. So I just think that the people really, you know, as we get into these moments and we start to think that I don't have the resources, we're thinking
right.
in a very narrow sort of way. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the sister because of the thought processes she has. But I'm just encouraging her to say, what have I not thought about in terms of the expansion of what I have access to? Because that
wow.
sometimes, that's limitless.
Yes, yes, man. That's so rich, man. Oh, my God, brother. Like, just so many jewels, man. A few that just stood out that I want to kind of revisit briefly is, like, you know, when you spoke about having, you know, writing down a list of the people who you feel that models the thinking or the energy of what you want your sons to grow into. That's so powerful, because generally a lot of that list is right on our phones. Like, if someone have had a phone for, you know, 5 to 10 years, there's certain contacts in there that do not want anything from you. All they want to do is pour into you. I have a friend that's doing this experiment, he called it, right now, whereas he's going through his list of contacts to cleanse and detox his phone, and he's categorizing them. So it would be like, these are these type of resources. These are these type of resources. These are people who I don't know, don't remember who they are. But I'm saying that to say what you are saying, like, we already have everything that we need, and we have to explore the community that we have built throughout the years. And even if we've led some interesting lives, we still have pockets of community that, you know, can balance out our interesting life that we've led.
Exactly.
And when you reach out to these people, it's nothing more that a teacher loves is for someone to reach out to them and they have the information readily available to just share. And that does not cost anything. So thank you for that, Brother Mark. That was powerful.
Thank you, brother. And I just want to just reinforce that with something you just said. It doesn't cost anything. It doesn't cost anything to reach out. And if you haven't connected, don't feel like, well, I haven't talked to them in so long, they just going to think that, you know, I need them, right? Most people want to feel needed. Most people want to feel like there's some purpose in their life beyond just, you know, the mundaneness that we experience sometimes. So if she reaches out to some, you know, respectable gentleman that she knows and who's an honorable person, and she said, hey, you know, could you be a mentor for my young men? Could we set up time that you talk to them? We're so used to Zooming Zoom now. Do some Zoom connections, you know, with them, and just talk to them about that. Because, you know, one of the things in these groups that I'm in, and they talk about, you know, a woman can't teach a man how to be a man. And, you know, I push back about that a little bit. I reframe it, because a woman can teach values to a man that man
Absolutely.
Then can take into his life and be a very respectable man. But but it's so important for that young man to see those values being played out by someone who that young man relates to, who I will be one day, right? I see this man doing this, what my mother tells me, so then that lesson is reinforced through example, right? So I think it's very important that again, it's about expansion. It's not about scarcity. Right.
We have to move away
from the concept of scarcity, like I don't have. Right. Reframe that and say, I don't know yet where it is, but I know it exists. And I am going to find it.
I'm going to find it.
I'm going to find it. I'm going to go on the journey because I know it's there. And sister, I'm telling you it's there. For your young men, 7, 9, and 13, it's out there. Right?
Yes.
It's just a matter of connection.
So
one of the last questions that I have, that someone wrote in from New York, close to where our attorney Winkler is. He's out in that area. How do you keep, and this was actually for Thea, because she talks about joy-centered life. So they say, how do you keep a joy-centered life? How do you keep happiness centered in your life? I'm going to throw that at you, brother. Oh, shit. I'll let you tackle that one first.
Oh, man, that's a beautiful one, man. I'm going to catch it like Jerry Rice. Oh, my God. Oh, that's so beautiful, brother. So how do you keep a joy-centered life? So, okay, so first we got to deal with joy, you know, happiness. How do you be happy? How do you have joy? Like, when you're dealing with joy and happiness, for me, I feel that joy is the offspring of choosing happiness, right? Because happiness is a choice for me. So when you are choosing happiness, for an example, you get up in the morning and you declare, like, happiness, right? And then what does that mean? That means only allowing, you know, positivity, encouragement, things that's going to, you know, feed other soul, spirit to come out your mouth. And then in that energy, like wearing that all through the day. And then when you wear that through the day, because happiness is a jacket that you could put on, but when you wear happiness through the day and smiling for no reason other than, like, we're being on the planet, and as Otis O'Solomon of the Watch Prophet says, and not taking it for granted, right? And you're showing that in your smile, and people will automatically become happy from your happiness. And then when two people are together and they're exchanging happiness, for me, that's where joy will just spring up, right? And then joy is something that you can take with you, take back home with you, and you can go to sleep with and wake up with, right? Because happiness is something that's kind of moment to moment, you know, you choose happiness, but when that joy gets stirred up from all the choices of happy that you've chosen over a specific period of time, man, joy is not something that you could just turn off, brother. Oh, joy is something that it turns
that.
On and it stays on, brother. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But see, so someone would say that, does that mean I'll get sad? Does that mean I won't have, if I'm doing what you're saying, that means I'll never experience strife.
That's not what I'm saying, because life is about mm-hmm. seasons, right? So right after spring, you know, there is, summer, at least for the last, 10,000 years that we know of, right after summer, it's fall, right? So I'm just saying, like, it's seasons, the seasons of life. Mm-hmm. However, when you can't get mad at the winter because you know it's about to come. You know, you just, like, prepare for it, right? And when we are prepared, like, and we can still be joyful in our preparation, and then when the winter come, probably knock over a barn or a house or whatever happens, brother, it's still the blessing is in the lesson, and joy is still centered in that. So you can be joyful and sad at the same time, right? You could go to a funeral and you can like wow, you could be sad because this person has transitioned, but the joy is they're not suffering anymore, right? So it's a balance. And I feel that we should be open to the balance of life.
That's beautiful, brother. You know what? When you said that, it made me reflect on my father, who passed away in June, and it was monumental sadness for me. And in that sadness, you know, I wanted to be connected to him, and I started looking at, you know, things that he's done. He was an actor and a voiceover guy, and I started looking at some of the stuff that he did, and I stumbled on this website about this game called Crash Bandicoot, and it's you know, kids game, and he did a voiceover for it. He played this character, Aku Aku. And there was so many accolades there about things, you know, how people felt experiencing his voice. And he was like, he was a father figure. And in that moment of sadness, I found this light of joy. Right. Ooh. And I kept that light in me. And that really helped me to move past that, man. And so when the sister spoke about, you know, how do you center joy, you know, it is about a choice, as you said, right? It's about you make a choice. And I just want people to know that, and something else you said when you were talking about fortifying your mind, that it's a process, right? You have to have these rituals that you go through, right? Because it doesn't happen automatically. There's a process that you have to put yourself through. So can you expand on that just a little bit in a few minutes, brother, about, you know, once you make the choice, you know, but that doesn't mean that then you just said, okay, I'm going to do it, and then walk away, right? You have to then go through a process. You have to fortify that joy. Talk about that a little
fortify
bit in a few minutes.
Absolutely, brother. Yeah, so exactly what you're saying. So after you make the choice, and then you move into this energy of non-negotiables and negotiables. And what that means is like the things that you're non-negotiable, what you will not, as you said earlier, take up real estate in your mind. Like I feel that people must guard their mind. Like if you got a friend that calls you with negative energy all the time and you listening but not responding, that energy is going into you. So you have to see what's being recorded on your spiritual hard drive. And when you really take inventory of that, you'll be mindful. Yes, you have to really take inventory of what's been recorded on your spiritual hard drive. And when you do that, you are able to then, stop the things, the viruses, the things that are being downloaded on there without your permission. You know how we have pop-ups and you click a pop-up and something just jump on your computer. You're like, how did this thing get on my computer? I don't even look at this type of XXX sites or whatever it is, right? But the thing about it is because, you know, you are – you don't have that virus protection, or you don't have that whatever you need to have to make sure that you don't see any of them pop-ups. It's the same thing with the spirit, with the mind, brother. We have to, as you said, fortify our mind. So when these pop-ups try to
be invasive, oh man, they're not vibrationally matched to how you're vibrating. And the only thing that you have to do is become the vibration you are looking to attract. As simple as that. So if you are looking to attract joy, peace, love, happiness, you just be that. Like, you just be that. How do you be it? There's ways. There's so many ways. That's a larger conversation. But you be that transmission. You be that vibration. And then you will only get that broadcast. However, if you start letting other stuff in, that channel will then be tuned right into you. And I feel a lot of people don't know how to unsubscribe from the negativity that's on their spiritual timeline. But you can unsubscribe from it. And that's another skill set that we teach.
And the eternal balance conversation.
Yes, absolutely, an internal balance, yes. And I'm trying not to shameless plug the book, but let me say this, Mark, because this has been such a great show. What I want to say is if anybody reaches out to the show and they would like a copy of Internal Balance, Would You Marry You, we would send them a free PDF copy of our book, man. All we need is an email, and we would love to get that out to them. So please just – Yes, yeah, it's just open. If 1,000 people say, hey, I want a copy, we'll send out 1,000 copies for free.
Give the email address, brother, because I know the work that you and your wife, Melanie, do, and it's transformative. And I know that it's not surface work. It goes deep into the things that, you know, people need to address to stay in this joy-centered mindset. So that offer is a beautiful offer. But so give the email address that they should send if anyone is interested in doing that, brother.
Yes. So if anyone is interested in doing it on Instagram, you can find us at Would You Marry You. Again, at Would You Marry You. And then it will pop up our works, and then you could reach us via email at internalbalanceretreats@gmail.com. So just send us an email, and we would love to respond with a copy of the book, and then, you know, keep this conversation going.
I love that, brother. As we close out, man, brother, the last 2 or 3 minutes, is there any closing words you want to offer, brother? Anything that from any of the questions that we got, or any closing thoughts that you have, brother?
You know what? I just want to say for everybody that's listening, be mindful that there's nothing. And Orlin Bishop said this. He didn't tell me this, but I was in one of his lectures many years ago. He's a very solid spiritual teacher. But he said this. He said, there's nothing that a conversation cannot heal. So I feel that all the people out there who are intimidated or running from having serious conversations, please open yourself up to the conversation, because as you were saying earlier, Mark, how many things happen with people that do not have these conversations? You know, this sister got resources in her phone, but if she's not open to the conversation, she would never access the equity. So I just would say, please be open to having a conversation, even with people who have wronged you, even with people you have wronged. The conversation is healing.
It's healing, brother. That's beautiful. And I'll just add to that, brother, that I'm going to echo first that you have to be open to having the conversations. You have to be open to going into spaces that you felt intimidated about. You felt that, you know, there was some wrong and you had maybe written it off, or reach back and think about the conversation we just had with Attorney Winkler. If you were going into a court situation, a custody situation, and you have all of these thoughts about, you know, what you're going to encounter in that courtroom, and that builds up a high level of anxiety and fear, and you feel like, well, I'm going to avoid it at all costs. You know, if you if you expand and you reach out and you have conversations with people who may have gone through it, people who've gone through it successfully, if you access resources like my book, My Daughter's Keeper, and there's so many other books and resources that people who have put things online about how they successfully gone through not just that, but through situations we talked about, that young, that person who was fearful about going back out. And you so brilliantly talked about the stages of how you can do that. It's just about, it's about expansion. It's about not staying in a bubble that you, a bubble of comfort that you've created for yourself, and that you feel comfortable and just running around that circle and only talking to people who you feel will reinforce comfort. It's about expanding past that. It's about having conversations that may seem uncomfortable at the moment, but as you get more into the conversations, you will find that it's not only helpful, but there's growth there. So, brother, this has been, I love doing these conversations, brother, because I grow, right? So,
right. You and me both. You and me both, man.
You and me both, brother. So we just want
on the other side.
On the other side, keep coming out. We invite you. We will put this on different platforms, and we hope to see you next time on the other side.
Peace.